Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Conversation with me, Amanda Duchadney. Today, I'm really honored to speak to Marissa Lee. She's an incredible author who wrote a book called Grief is Love. Marissa brings a very unique and powerful perspective to the grieving process. And in this episode, she'll share four essential strategies to support those who are grieving and offer three actionable tips for friends who are looking to help someone through the pain of losing a loved one. Whether you're currently experiencing any kind of loss or supporting someone who is, I really hope you'll enjoy this episode because it is packed with invaluable insights.
Hi, Marissa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm not gonna lie. It has been a day over here.
Has
it? The dryer broke. The nanny called in sick. Yeah. So we are in it today, girl. We are in it.
Oh God, no. It is so fine. Marissa, you are a writer. You're addressing and exploring issues that are difficult. Grief is one of the most polarizing and unique experiences for everybody that goes through it. You sent me your book, Grief is Love, when I was navigating the death of my father 18 months ago. And I want to thank you for reaching out at that time, because I have to say, as you knew, because you had experience in this area and I was navigating it for the first time, it is extremely difficult and challenging, and all the things that it is. And yeah, one of the things that sustained me and kept my head literally above water was the kindness of strangers during that time frame when I was in so much pain and I was struggling so much. And you were one of the people who kindly reached out and sent me your book, which was an amazing gesture. And I'm so grateful, because it was like stepping into a room that I had never been in before, and I needed to learn a new language that I had no clue what it was. And between you and a handful of other people who shared their profound work with me, I received a lot of comfort. So thank you.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad. Yeah, a girlfriend of mine saw a reel you did and she tagged me in it. And I listened to your story talking about your grief and your dad. And I was like, oh yeah, we'll just send her a copy of the book. I wish I could just give them all away, because my whole purpose for writing it was to give other people what I didn't have when I lost my mom almost 16 years ago. So I'm glad it was helpful. And
It really was. How do you describe the kind of writer you are? Like, when people say, what do you do?
Oh gosh, there have been so many titles and taglines, but right now I've decided what I really want to be known for and what I've done throughout my career, whether in politics or even briefly when I was in finance, my consulting work, my writing, my speaking, et cetera. I want to help people figure out how to live well when the worst things happen. So whether that is writing about the loss of my mom, sharing my infertility. Last night, I did a series on our adoption journey. I shared a lot this summer when we were navigating both Matt's mom's sickness. Matt's my husband, for context, and she was dying from stage 4 breast cancer this whole year. And at the same time, in the middle of that, my cousin was killed by an abusive partner. And so I try to show people, we don't get to decide what happens to us in this life. I didn't raise my hand and ask for my mom to be sick when I was a kid and then be dead by the time I turned 25. But we do get to decide what we do with these things and what we do in the midst of them. And I just want to create things that make it easier for people to live well when the worst things happen.
That's a beautiful intention to have. When I was listening to you say that, I was thinking, yes, we don't get to choose what happens, but we do get to choose how we respond to those things.
Yep.
And it often feels like we don't have choices when we're in it because it's so overwhelming emotionally. And there's so many different emotional experiences going on that it may feel like we're stuck on one track of having to respond a certain way. And I love what you're talking about, which is giving people choices and reminding people, here's a way that you could go based on one person, on Marissa's experience. Here's a path that could be a possibility for you.
Exactly. That's what I want to give people.
One of the things that I love is in the inside of your book, you talk about transformation. And the transformation that we each undergo after loss, because inevitably that for me is the key, where we have these experiences and we either are broken by them and then put ourselves back together.
Yep.
Or, well, for me, I was cracked open. Right. And cracked in a way that I was like, oh, wait, how am I ever going to function again? And there is an inevitable, the gift is the transformation. Like that's the gift on the other side of it.
Exactly. And I don't think, I'll be honest, I don't think I got to a place where I was clear that that was the word, you know, that transformation was the key until our son showed up unexpectedly when I was in the final stages of writing this book, because there was so much about finally suddenly becoming a mom and recognizing that now that I am Bennett's mom, I will never not be Bennett's mom, no matter what happens in the cliff. I don't lose that title. I don't lose that part of myself. And I realized, oh, and my mom is always going to be my mom, no matter how long she hasn't been in this world. And when I lost her, I suddenly went from Marissa, whose mom is Lisa, who's sick, who she helps take care of, who's an active, very vocal presence in her daily life, to Marissa, daughter of someone who died this morning. If you recognize it as a transformative experience, just the way we recognize life at the beginning as a transformative experience, I think it makes it a lot easier to move through the worst and most painful parts of grief. Because transformation, nobody says it's easy. It gives you a framework for understanding part of why it's so hard.
Yeah. Do you think that we are, as a culture, becoming more willing to discuss death?
A little bit. Not as much as I would like to see, obviously, as the girl who thinks about it all the time. But I definitely think there is more of an openness. There is more interest. There are more people being public about their feelings about a wide variety of difficult things, including death and loss and grief. And I think there's more attention being paid to it. I still don't think it's enough, especially when you stop and think about how much loss we sustained as a country just from COVID. In a span of under 2 years, we lost over a million Americans to one thing, and we don't really talk about it anymore.
Well, I also think that the tools that are available and the support is negligible in comparison to what has happened.
Oh my God, yes.
There's barely even a language for it. It's like people don't even have the words. People,
no.
And here's the thing. I'm someone who has, I would say, a pretty high EQ. And I didn't even know what I was feeling was grief.
No.
When my dad died, I was like, what is this? It was anger and just all these emotions that I didn't even realize. Someone who is more educated than I was with grief said to me, oh, this sounds like grief. Really? I didn't even know what it looked like.
That's because for so long, all we've seen around death and grief and loss in popular culture is somebody dies everybody gets dressed up in black, they go to the funeral, and then everybody moves on. And that's just absolutely not how it actually works. I know for the rest of my life, there are going to be moments when I have to reckon with the loss of my mom. I'm not 16 years out in a place where I'm waking up crying every day. No, it's not like that. But it's one of those things where I know I feel a certain way around Mother's Day. The holidays are amazing, and I'm so excited to have this enthusiastic little toddler to do Christmas and Thanksgiving stuff with. But I'm always going to have some, you know, sad feelings, nostalgia, just a sense that I miss this woman who made Christmas magical for our family for the first 25 years of my life. It was her thing. It was her jam. There are just always going to be these little moments, because it's not like suddenly I forget that she ever existed or that we had this amazing relationship.
Right. And so coming to terms with the feeling of missing somebody.
Yeah. And that it's okay. It's normal.
Right.
So I'm sure you have a lot of those moments.
Yeah. I still can't believe that my dad is gone. I sometimes wake up in the morning and I think, oh, I've got to call him, or I wonder what's happening with that thing. I need to speak to him. And then I'm like, oh, he's not here anymore. I don't want to say it hasn't sunk in, but it still feels like, what? He's not here?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I probably spent years, because I traveled a bunch for work around the time I lost my mom. And whenever I would go somewhere, you know, I would call her, because texting still wasn't that big back then, and let her know that I got there safely. You know, the number of times I would be on a business trip in Texas or California and pick up the hotel room phone and realize, oh, I can't call her. I mean, it would happen on and off for years. Like, I still, every once in a while, even now, I will have just a very vivid and realistic dream where she is a part of our life in some way now. And when I first wake up for just a couple of seconds, I'll think like, oh, that wasn't real. Like, you were just sleeping that whole time.
What's your thought on how real that experience is when your mother is in your dream? Because some people feel that that is a way that people who have passed can still communicate with you. What's your thoughts on that?
I absolutely think it's possible. I am someone who generally tries to remain open to all things being possible that we can't fully understand. I grew up religious in the church, was a Sunday school teacher, all the things. I don't know where my mom is, so to speak. You know, I don't know what happens when you die. I have no idea. And I hope to not find out for a very long time. But what I do believe is our people are very much still with us. And I think they can show up in a variety of ways. You know, sometimes where I've had a dream that has involved my mom, you know, it's been because I've needed to deal with something else, whether related to our infertility journey, pregnancy loss, some work situation that I need to work through. It's like she usually shows up when there is something that either she is trying to push me on, I think, or you could say just something that I need to work on or work through. And I'm always grateful for it.
So you've seen a kind of thread with that.
Yeah, a little bit. I can remember, and I was just reflecting on this yesterday, having dreams with my mom in them very close to the time when we got our call from the adoption agency that our son was here. And at the time, we were just playing the waiting game. I didn't have any proof of anything other than my gut instinct and my mom showing up. And I did have a dream the week before we got the call about Bennett, about this baby that he does kind of resemble. That was ours. And I believe from that moment on, I was like, we're going to get our baby before the end of the year. And we got our call about a week later.
Wow, amazing. I choose to believe those experiences too. They just feel right to me. It feels right to go, oh yeah, that's what that was. And it's a personal choice, right? I don't know where we go either, but I know that when I've had moments of feeling that connection, I don't even question it. I just go, okay, that's what it is.
Yes. Yes. Do you see your dad other places or in things? I have a girlfriend who lost her mom when we were younger, and butterflies were her mom's thing. Her mom's also a science teacher. And so anytime she sees a butterfly, or really at this point, anytime any of us see a butterfly, we think of Sylvia.
Oh, that's so lovely. My friend's dad is also a butterfly, and I send her pictures of butterflies when I see them because that she told me that's what her dad is. Oh. I see my dad, I hear his voice in my head sometimes, and it's like I'm just having a conversation. So I have that kind of back and forth. If I was to close my eyes, it could be like we're on the phone or something, but it's just in my head.
Yes.
You know, I have that. Also, my dad had a real connection with hummingbirds, and he had a hummingbird feeder at his house, and there was always hummingbirds, and they would come and land on his finger.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. Amazing. And so where I live in Los Angeles, I had never seen hummingbirds before. And then right when my dad passed, I started noticing one little tiny hummingbird in the distance. I was sitting in the bath one day soon after he passed, and a hummingbird came in the middle of the window and looked at me through the window. I was like, oh my God, hi. Things like that. I did say to my dad before he left, I said, listen, if there's any way you can communicate with me, I'm up for it. I'm just telling you, I'm giving you permission. I welcome it. I invite it. And he said, okay, so I'm up for it. My dad was a race car driver, and he taught me how to ride a motorbike at 6 years old. I had a little tiny motorbike. And he always told me, never get on the back of a guy's bike, ever. It's too high risk. You need to learn how to ride a bike. And you tell him that he gets on the back, which I did multiple times. But five, 6 years my dad was alive, he actually had my motorbike and he rode it. And today I get my motorbike back. That's very symbolic for me.
Oh, I'm so glad you're getting that back. That is awesome.
Yeah. So with your journey with helping support people through grief, what are some of the things that you think are helpful for people to know?
So first thing that I just want to share, just as a framing piece, everything in grief is love. Yes, they're my stories and my mistakes and experiences, but all of the advice is grounded in the leading data and research around grief and loss and healing. And so I want folks to know these aren't just my opinions. These are things that have been looked at and studied and that really do help, because while everyone's grief journey is absolutely different, there are certain things that scientists believe help us heal when we lose someone we love. And so I realized the number one thing for me in terms of how I deal with my grief and how I've gotten to this place of comfort around it is by giving myself permission to grieve. I needed to let go of any expectations that I had about what it was supposed to look like, what it was supposed to feel like, how long it was supposed to last, when it was going to show up, et cetera, et cetera. There are lots of really amazingly powerful and positive moments in my life, and I'm sure the same goes for you, where I feel my grief the most. You know, these times when everybody expects you to be happy and cheerful, and you might feel some amount of happiness or joy or pride in an accomplishment, but then there's also this piece of, and they're not here to share it with you. That can be hard sometimes. I encountered this a lot when I was planning my wedding. I had a really hard time without my mom. When I got to introduce my dad to former President Obama, her not being there for that experience, you know, Black family, first Black president, like there were just so many pieces of it that I know she would have loved. And that was really hard. When our son showed up, my husband, I met him 4 years after my mom died. So he's never met my mom. But a few days in, we were both so sleep deprived. The two of us were literally in tears, just crying, wishing she could be there to help us out. And he'd never even met the woman. And so giving yourself permission allows for you to embrace those, frankly, sometimes shitty feelings and know that you're going to move through them and there's nothing wrong with you. Thing two is let go of the stages of grief. The Stages of Grief were originally developed by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, brilliant researcher, not for you or for me, but they were for people who were terminally ill themselves.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm so pleased that you're reframing this, because that is a misconception that is very common.
And it causes people a lot of pain.
Yeah.
Because we think of stages as this sequential thing. And then when
it's finite.
Yes.
And there's a beginning, middle, and end. And that just isn't
Exactly. And I truly believe if she were still alive, we could have this conversation with her and she'd be like, yeah, that got lost in a game of telephone. Yeah. And here are some other things that are more helpful. So please get rid of the stages. Stop making yourself just nuts about them. And then I would say the third thing, and this was very important for me, especially around the loss of our pregnancy, and that is you need real care and support to move through grief and loss, whether that is a faith leader, mental health professional, someone in your community joining a grief support group. The dinner party is great. Option B does some really amazing work. Modern loss, et cetera. You need help and you need to really take care of yourself, because grief has a very meaningful, measurable impact on our bodies and on our brains, and it makes it hard for us to function. And so finding the right care and support is critically important. And then the last thing that I will say is, and this is always one of my most important things, you need joy. And don't feel like in experiencing moments of joy and lightness and humor and fun that you are somehow forgetting about your person or minimizing the extent of your loss or the pain that you're in. But the body and the brain actually need breaks from the heaviness of grief in order to heal and repair and recalibrate. So when you are experiencing joy in the midst of grief, you are healing. And I just think it's really important for people to know that.
That's really valuable. You've probably heard about probiotics and the importance of a healthy gut microbiome. Well, I've got some news for you. Over 15 years of research on the vaginal microbiome have revealed that our gut isn't the only part of our body that thrives on an optimal microbiome. For years, Seed has been my go-to for improving my family's gut health, so I'm excited that Seed has launched VSO1 Vaginal Symbiotic. Your period, exercise, diet, sex, this can all mess with your vaginal microbiome, making it sensitive to imbalances and unwanted, uncomfortable issues. And I don't need to tell you that there's nothing worse than feeling like something is off with your vagina. That's why I'm so into Seed's VSO1. It's the first vaginal probiotic suppository designed to nourish your vagina with the essential biome it needs to flourish. I've read the research and I've interviewed the scientist behind VSO1, and I've decided to give my vagina the attention she deserves. If you want to check it out, please go to seed.com/AmandaC and use 25 Amanda C for 25% off your first month supply of Seed.
It's been a year since my dad's memorial. So we're coming up on his birthday in 7 days and the day of his memorial. I've given myself really a year to not have answers to anything, to say, I don't know where this journey is going to take me. I have no idea what the outcome of this is going to be. What I do know is that my dad's parting gift to me was myself. And that I know, right? And you're smiling because you know what I'm talking about. And I don't know what the picture really looks like yet. I've got kind of pieces of like, oh, this is what my life looks like now. But a transformation is an understatement in every area, personally, professionally, like a recalibration of everything. And I'm in it. I'm still in it. And I've been able to give myself that time and space. For the first time in my life, I have stopped working at the rate that I was working since I started working at age 15. I never stopped, even through my twin pregnancy. I just never stopped. And this is the first time in my adult life that I've given myself that space, because I quite frankly had to. I just couldn't.
Yeah, you need it.
I needed it. So what about people who cannot give themselves that space because they have kids to take care of, they have multiple jobs? I've been thinking about those people a lot because I barely made it through the toughest times with giving myself space and time. What about people who can't get that?
So I think about that a lot. I was someone who couldn't give myself a lot of space and time when I lost my mom. You know, Black, first generation, I was in my first job on Wall Street. If I took a break from working, I don't know what would have happened. There wasn't anyone who could support me. And I was just really young when it happened too. So as much as my community did, and they were amazing, it was still a very challenging and lonely and isolating experience. I was back in the office on Wall Street during the height of the financial crisis, 2 weeks after we buried my mom. And every morning I could get myself up after a couple hours of sleep, caffeinated, dressed, off to work. And the second that I would step off of the 4 or 5 train at Wall Street to leave the subway and go to my office, I would start having a debilitating panic attack. Like even just talking about it now, like my palms start to sweat again. I can see myself. I can see where I was walking, just trying to hide the fact that I'm physically shaking. I'm about to burst into tears. My heart feels like it's going to blow completely through my chest. And I just need to get to a place where I can hide and collapse and fall apart. And I would get myself to the basement of my bank. And that is exactly what I did every morning for months. And the only reason why I even know now how long I did it for is because the only other girl who worked in banking with me at the time had become a friend. And each morning she would come down to the basement with a Xanax and a latte and a cookie. And wow. I would take those things, redo my makeup, and go up to work as though nothing had ever happened. Mm. And that's just how I lived. And that, to be clear, is like a place of privilege. I didn't have children I was caring for. I wasn't working at Starbucks and Walmart. I was working on Wall Street. That was all still a privileged grief experience 15 years ago. And so I think about those folks all the time because I was writing Grief is Love in the midst of the pandemic, and we were watching the people who are the least able to absorb death and grief and pain be the most punished. It was poor communities, mostly communities of color, that were the most ravaged and destroyed by COVID. And we know that that's not just the case for COVID. That is the case for everything. If you are a Black child in this country, you are 3 times as likely as a white child to lose your mother before you turn 18. If you are 30 years old and Black in this country, you are 30% more likely than a white person of the same age to have already sustained the loss of multiple close family members. And so we know that this is happening. We know that it is a problem. And just like anything else that is focused on care in this country, we don't prioritize it. What we need are better systems and policies in place to catch people when they fall into states of grief and trauma and chronic emotional stress. And we don't have any of that. And so I view my role and the role of people like you and other folks like us as grief advocates. We know the privilege that we have. And so what we have to do is keep talking about it and push for more and push for significant policy change, corporate culture change, more mental health resources, easier to access mental health resources, all of the things, because they are not equally distributed in this country. And right now, healing from grief is a privilege.
I am very pleased that we're talking about this, because one of the things that I am really interested in doing is working out creating a grief curriculum for schools and for teachers and for educators. would be so invaluable because nobody knows how to speak about this. People are very uncomfortable when it comes to death and loss and certainly grief. Yep. And what if people were educated and had more training around supporting others in that community who are going through this? So it's something that I've been thinking about a lot. I know it will be a heavy lift, but I think it's something that would be so worth it.
No, I agree. I've thought about curriculums and trainings because I think a lot in terms of impact. That's like my politics policy maker brain.
I love that.
And I think about grief, both in the context of what we've experienced through the loss of parents and other loved ones, but I also just think about all of the grief that so many, but especially young people, have experienced the last few years as they've missed out on these critical moments.
Milestones.
Childhood,
developmental. Yes.
What are we doing for these kids? And how are we going to make sure that they're ready for the workforce?
We're not. When I say the word resilience, I mean learning to move through something, not barrel through it, not check out and self-medicate through it, but giving people tools because loss is an inevitable part of life. Whether it is loss of a friendship, loss of a job, loss of a pet, loss of your identity. It can be so many things. As we move through stages of life, we're going to experience more and more loss that is just a natural, healthy part of life. I really feel like teaching people about what loss looks like, what it feels like, and a variety of tools. It doesn't mean it's going to fix you, but it's going to help you move through it.
Exactly. Exactly. I wish I had something to give people that would just make it all go away. I'd be a millionaire for sure.
A billionaire. But having said that, I have to be honest with you that when I reflect back to last year, and I said this to somebody the other day, would I wish that my dad was still here? Yes. What I also experienced on top of the loss of my dad was the loss of friends who were not able to show up. And telling you, people who were on my favorites list on my phone, I was like, wait, you're not able to show up? And I would say that the loss of the friends who weren't able to show up on top of the loss of my dad really compounded the original loss. Would I wish that on my worst enemy? No. Would I choose to not have had that experience? No. Because what it gave me was so deeply profound that I could not imagine not having the insight that I now have that is guiding me on this next phase.
100%. First of all, I'm sorry that you had to experience that. That's painful. I wrote in Grief is Love, Grief is a Relationship Crucible. Because you learn who your people really are. Because it isn't easy to figure out how to show up and how to support someone through grief, especially if you've never been there yourself. But when we love people, we have to find a way. And so I always get the question of, what do I do? And so I have three things that I share for people when they're like, I want to show up, I don't know how. The first thing is just be there, be a witness. If someone just got the worst news of their life, just go sit with them, bring them a cup of coffee or shot of bourbon, in my case, too, whatever you can to support them, but just be there. You don't have to have the right words because there are no right words. And I say this as a grief writer, just be a witness. The second thing is provide some sort of practical help. We've talked about this. Grief has a very real impact on our bodies and our brains. So do something to make life easier. Take a work assignment off of their plate, bring them dinner, pick their kids up from soccer, walk their dog, whatever it is. Just find something practical that makes life easier. And then the third thing, and this is core to who I am because it's core to who my mom was, do something that brings them joy, whether it is a gift that reminds them of who they are independent of this experience, or something that points to their relationship with the deceased. Do something to give them a little bit of a smile.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Those are great tangible tools.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be anything fancy. You know, I'll never forget, and I still sometimes get teared up when I talk about this one, when we had our pregnancy loss in 2019, I was in complete denial. I really believed that my blood work had been confused with some other poor woman who I sent a prayer for as I drove to Walgreens to get my own pregnancy test. And even after that test was obviously negative, I couldn't wrap my mind around. I couldn't talk about it. I wasn't even crying. The level of devastation was just too overwhelming for me. And so a couple of my roommates from college who lived locally, we were in DC at the time, they showed up that night and they brought cookie dough and they brought bourbon. And we watched American Ninja Warrior, which was so random. I don't think I've ever watched the show since. Nobody talked about it. Nobody even was like, how are you doing? Because they knew that this was, it was just unspeakable at that point. But they came and they were there. And Matt and I will never forget that.
Yeah, you don't forget the people who showed up or who reached out. No. That's what I'm saying. When you reached out to me and you sent me your book, I remember all the people who gave me kindness and who showed me kindness, who didn't even know me. And I remember the people that didn't. I'm sorry to say. I do. Like,
it hurts.
I do. Oh, boy.
And remember, and I had to spend a lot of time on this myself. It took years. For me, I think about forgiveness as just me letting go of the thing. That doesn't mean that you have to let these people back in. That's the distinction for me between forgiveness and grace. Like, grace is something that you extend to someone who you know deserves to be let back in, who genuinely made a mistake and who does the work to get back into your good graces, so to speak.
Marissa, do you feel like this path of educating and supporting people through grief is something that you'll be on for a while, or are there other things that have come into your realm of being that you feel like I need to shed the light on this too?
So, good question. I have submitted a proposal to my publisher for my next book. And by the time this airs, I think it will be out in the world. So I'm going to talk about it. I realized this year, as I worked to support Matt and his family through his mother's illness, and then at the same time ended up in a position of support for my aunt and her family around the disappearance. And then we eventually learned death of my cousin, that there is something to be said for how to like really be in it with someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, American culture is so worshipful of all things independence and putting yourself first. And yet we have evolved as human beings to be in community. So what do you do and how do you live and how do you live well when you are in it with someone else? Whether it's somebody you love is dying, or growing up, my mom had MS and I was in it with her from the time I was 13. I have a friend who has ALS and I see the ways that his wife is in it with him. What are the impacts of that secondary trauma? And how do you live well when you are deeply in it with someone else? And it's not something that ends anytime soon.
Wow. Yes. Okay. So you're right. We live in a sort of in a toxic individualistic culture. And that is part of the capitalistic structure that most of us have been raised on. And I agree with you and obviously know that we come from more of community living. And I feel a strong need and urge to recreate that in some way, because I do see the value of it. And culturally, it's not something that's encouraged. In fact, if you are considered a caregiver, what you're talking about is caring and being in it with somebody, which so many people are in that role. And that kind of, a lot of people look down on other people that do that. And it's really one of the most generous
noble things you can do for somebody else. I mean, I'm filled with gratitude and awe of people who choose jobs that are in the caregiving industries and or choose to do that for a loved one.
Yeah. And the idea that people look down on it is something that I absolutely felt this last year. I have a consulting business that I run. I had a book that had just come out. I have, thankfully, lots of great professional opportunities. And at the end of the day, when I went into this year, I realized the most important thing I could do in 2023 for the person that I try to be in the world was to do everything I could to support Matt and his family, and by extension, take care of myself so that I could provide them with that support. And I decided no matter what happens, I would not look back on choosing to love and support the people that I love as any sort of negative thing. Like, how could that ever be a negative thing?
Yeah, I think what's key there is how you can support yourself to be able to show up for them. Because if there is a negative, it is purely the fact that a lot of people are not supported or educated about how to take care of themselves so that they can show up, and they become depleted and overwhelmed and drained. And then it's not good for anybody.
Yes. And sometimes there are real lasting physical and mental health consequences. And I want to look at what those are. In my case, a year after my mom first got sick, I suddenly developed these chronic stomach aches.
I knew you were going to say stomach ache. I was like, I almost said the word. Yeah, that makes sense.
And it was the 90s. Nobody was saying, oh, you know, maybe we should send this kid for counseling. They just put me on medication. And I've been on and off medication for gut health issues since I was a kid. And last year, when things were really bad with other parts of my health and Matt's mom and you know, all of the things,
stresses,
it got a lot worse. The health stuff that now I have to deal with as a result of caretaking in a way that was detrimental for me.
This is a huge, huge subject. Huge. I really hope that your publisher gets behind this because this is so important.
I'm glad you think so.
I do. Yeah,
I saw it firsthand, and the thing that I kept asking myself as I worked to balance what did I need to be okay with, how am I showing up for these other people that I love? Where is the line between compassion and self-preservation? And how do you
differentiate
sure that?
Wow. Marissa, this has been such a wonderful opportunity. I'm so pleased that we got to chat. I really am.
Same. Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much for listening to that fantastic episode. Please like, subscribe, and all that business. It does really help the podcast. And most importantly, come join me on Substack. Substack is where I'm showing the video of the entire episode that you just listened to. So find me on Substack if you want to dig in a bit deeper to the subjects that we talked about in this episode. See you there.